Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the Central Florida Community Arts Symphony Orchestra, presenting Celebrate the Season, December 4th and 5th at Northland in Longwood. The country's largest orchestra shares traditional melodies, orchestral showstoppers, and more. Ticket information at cfcarts.com/NPR.
I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to one of the most unusual and inspiring shows on the radio, a show that shines a light on people that are living lives of purpose, passion, and adventure, and proves that we can all do it. It's called Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton, and that is Bill Schaefer right over there. And all we ask is that you give us a few minutes and see for yourself, as you'll hear from renowned experts, best-selling authors, and seemingly ordinary people that are living extraordinary lives. Growing Bolder is a radio show, a TV show, a magazine, a website, and more, all featuring three ingredients: hope, inspiration, and possibility.
And today they're brought to you by some pretty big names and some even bigger hearts. You'll meet writer and author Delia Ephron, whose latest book deals with her sister Nora's death and what it took to overcome it. We'll talk to a woman in her 90s whose selfless act at the end of the Vietnam War saved tens of thousands of children. And if you like big-name musicians, you're here for the right show. His biggest hit came in 1976 with Dreamweaver. Yeah, Gary Wright is here. And do you like the B-52s? We'll talk to Fred Schneider about a new project he's working on. But first, we'll start with one of the most iconic musical performers of the 50s. Amazing people, amazing stories. It's time for Growing Bolder.
On a day like today, we pass the time away.
Mark, what are you doing? You know this song, don't you?
We are swaying back and forth, everybody in the control room.
I know that you know who sings this song. Yeah. I wonder how many people listening right now. Go ahead and guess. Well, just to give you an idea of how big this guy and this song was, Love Letters in the Sand was on the charts for more consecutive weeks than Elvis's Don't Be Cruel and more than the Beatles' Hey Jude. Can you believe that? And it's just one of top 10 hits that this guy had.
You know, I can believe it because it's still
good.
Man, it is spectacular.
It's mellow and smooth like peanut butter over bread.
This song alone would be more than enough of a career for most anybody, but this is not an ordinary guy.
No.
He is also a movie star. He's been on Broadway. He's written 15 books. He's been married for 60 years. He's also become a big-time basketball player. Yep. Pretty unusual for a guy who just celebrated his 80th birthday. He's an icon, folks, a talent, an all-round great guy. We are happy to say hello to, you guessed it, Mr. Pat Boone. Hey, Pat, how are you?
That's quite an intro. I will say that the peanut butter these days is crunchy peanut butter.
We may not have any time left for the interview, but we got you one heck of a intro, didn't
nice.
We?
Nice. Talk to you again sometime.
Hey, you know, let's talk about this basketball thing first, because obviously we got a lot of great questions about your career. First of all, congratulations on turning 80. How do you feel, and why are you playing basketball?
Well, of course, I did play in the senior games, was it a year or 18 months ago, and I was on a team in the 75 to 79 age bracket, and it was amazing to me how many guys there are in that bracket who still can move around the court and shoot, and I mean, we had some competitive games. I played with a group out of Washington, D.C., actually Virginia, called the Virginia Creepers. and we won our first two games, and I did score both times, both games, and gave the guy I was defending against fits. But I must say I had a brace on my right knee, and I paid a price. I was limping for a few days just because I've run all the meniscus cartilage out of, really both knees, but the left knee I had a partial replacement. It's great. And I'm still playing singles tennis, but I'm not playing much basketball now because I realize I just can't move as quickly on the court. I could if it weren't for the knee. I'm aerobically fit. But so that's a very long answer to a very simple question.
You know, Pat, there are no radio shows in this country that would refuse to have you on as a guest. You're such a great, compelling guy. But there's a specific reason that we wanted you on Growing Bolder, because you've done such an amazing job. At the age of 80, you're vital, you're relevant, you're involved, you're smart, you're all over everything, Pat. What is your secret? What is your philosophy that for aging that keeps you? I mean, you found the fountain of youth.
Well, I think it's crossword puzzles. If you do a lot of crossword puzzles, it's good brain exercise. I mean, I'm kidding, but there's truth to that as well. But look, I tell people, they've been asking me for I don't know, 40 years at least, why do you look younger than we know you are and act younger? And I say, well, it's three things. It's lots of milk, lots of exercise, and a clean conscience. And, of course, the milk has to do with diet, and I switched to low-fat a long time ago. But just the good food, I mean, and then exercise, self-explanatory. But then the clean conscience, and people look at me quizzically about that. And I say, look, my conscience gets dirty like anybody's, but I know where to go to get mine cleaned. And there's a physiological as well as spiritual and emotional benefit to that, because people, you know, by and large, go through life carrying guilt complexes. And I like the joke of the psychiatrist who said to his patient who was really messed up, look, you don't have a guilt complex. You're guilty. You know, it's not complex. And so physiological effects, diseases, all come from anxiety, fear, and sometimes guilt. And I just, and that's where my faith comes in, because I can confess my faults whenever I need to and then know that they're forgiven and I can start fresh. And I can do that on a daily basis. So, you know, having a healthy, clean self-image, not because of anything I've done, but because what's been done for me by God. And then having a healthy body and a good wife. I mean, Solomon says in Proverbs that's after all of his incredible blessings and largesse, that it boiled down to that. That's the secret of the happy life, is to have something good to eat, something good to do, and have a good wife or husband.
Man, you knocked the cover off that ball. Folks, we are talking to Pat Boone, the iconic singer, actor, movie star, basketball player, all-around great guy. And Bill mentioned you in the same breath as Elvis and the Beatles, and you just talked about living with a clean conscience, doing things the right way. You know, current names that come to example, Miley Cyrus and Justin Bieber, it seems like it's hard to become as famous in your business as you have been without being controversial. Somehow, you've avoided controversy, you've done it the right way, and you've still risen to the top. I mean, we need more like you.
Well, remember, I came up at a different time. I have a book that I've written in the last, well, a couple of years, called Pat Boone's America, 50 Years. And the reason I did it, I'd already written other biographical or autobiographical books, and the publisher convinced me that it had been at least 10 years since the one before, so I must have had other experiences. Of course I had, but I didn't think it was worth a book. But I agreed to do it if I could tell my story, my career and life story, overlying the changes in culture in America since I began. When I began, it was okay to be a nice guy. I mean, Elvis and I were competitors, and he was sort of the rebel, and he was winning big by sort of breaking through some taboos. I was the guy like Mr. America, you know, obeying all the rules, going to college, getting married, having kids. And living a clean life, and kids identified with both of us, but for different reasons. But it was okay for me to be a quote nice guy. I shrank from that word because that seemed uncommercial, and yet I resisted the impulse to try to be like Elvis. And of course, he was an immense success, but he's been gone 30 or 40 years. And I'm still going strong. So there's something to be said for sticking to the tried and true principles and morals that have always spelled health and happiness. And I regret, I really hurt for these kids who are coming along who really do believe that the way to be successful is to break every taboo, stick their tongues out, give you the finger, do drugs, rebel. And of course, other kids, unfortunately, find that exciting. And they'll buy the records and go to the movies and be followers. And it's really the kind of the blind leading the blind.
You know, Pat, in our last minute or so, you know, you've been through it all. You've seen so many different things, and you just talked about the young kids. When you were 20, 25, 30, and you thought about an 80-year-old, wow, there were not many role models out there like you are now. What is it like to be 80, and what is it like to be on the cusp of changing the stereotype of what that means?
I tell you, it is. I cannot really accept or quite comprehend it. Not only am I 80, but still going strong. I just rode 3 miles on my bike this morning. I alternate between bike and swimming in the morning, and then I work out in the gym in the afternoons, and then play tennis, singles tennis, 3 sets on Friday. So, I mean, I cannot accept that I'm anybody's stereotype of 80. But then again, my youngest daughter, my baby daughter, is a grandmother, and so that makes an impression on me. That's also hard to comprehend. The other girls, the older three, are not grandparents yet. But baby daughter Laurie, who's 56, I think, and she's got 3 grandkids and a 4th on the way. And I don't know what's wrong with the other grandkids. But at least now Shirley and I are great grandparents, courtesy of our youngest daughter.
Well, Pat, listen, keep doing what you're doing, and thanks so much for setting that bar high for the rest of us to follow. Keep active and relevant, and keep shaping the image of what's possible later in life. Our thanks to the iconic, amazing, incredible Pat Boone. Up next, he's the front man to one of the greatest party bands ever. It's Fred Schneider of the B-52s. This is Growing Bolder. Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. Oh, yeah, this is Growing Bolder Radio. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and after 35 years and 20 million records, the B-52s are still flying high, and a big part of the reason why, Mark, is their bombastic frontman, Fred Schneider.
You know, we were thrilled to find out that he is still crazy, still motivated, still as creative as ever. But do you know much about his background, how the Bees came to be? Well, you're about to find out. Hop in our Chrysler. Bill, put the top down. Let's cruise, and we'll tell you all about it.
It was 1989 when the B-52s released their biggest selling single ever. Did you know it almost never happened?
The record label didn't think Love Shack would be a hit. Radio wouldn't touch it except for college radio and alternative.
You sure?
They thought it was too weird, and I think this is the most accessible, one of the most accessible things we've done. I got me a Chrysler, and it's about 20,
so hurry up and bring your jukebox money. Fred Schneider was right. After 13 years of toil and struggle, Love Shack made the B-52s an overnight sensation. Stay away, fools, the club rules at the Love Shack. And Brad Schneider was suddenly considered one of the most unique performers in music, knocking at the door of stardom. It was a sweet victory for a man who for most of his life was seen by friends as a disappointment.
They said to my mother, "Oh, Carol, it's so sad that Freddie dropped out of college." Then, you know, they're asking for tickets to shows later on.
To be honest, nobody was more surprised by their success than the B-52s themselves. Kate Pearson, Cindy Wilson, her late brother Rick, and Keith Strickland.
The whole band, the Bees, we just took a chance. We lived life in Athens, and you only had hopes. We never knew what we could do.
In fact, they all did other things. Fred was a custodian and became a meal delivery coordinator for the Georgia Council on Aging.
We all had like jobs. Keith and Ricky worked at the bus station. Cindy worked at the Whirly Q Lunchette making peachy burger melts. And Kate worked, as she said, at the local rag.
And were you one of those guys that had that dream while you were doing that? That, man, maybe our band can have a hit record?
No, it was like, hey, this is fun. Because in Athens, there wasn't anything to do at the time. It wasn't a music mecca. We just did it because we liked it.
Doing it because they liked it. It's what drives Fred to this very day.
Like I say, thank God for Love Shack. I'll never get sick of it.
And now the Superions.
Yes, and we're going to sell millions.
You see, Fred has started a whole new band. Oh, he's still in the B-52s, and they'll always be his main gig, but he also started the Superions.
What do you hope happens with this album and this group?
You know, like million sellers, you know, world stardom, just basic, whatever, you know, person in the band wants.
Some critics think they're already on their way, with titles like...
Who threw that ham at me?
And
fruitcake, heavy as lead. Fruitcake, if it hits you in the head. Fruitcake, it could kill you dead. It's fruitcake.
And their biggest project to date.
Fat baby, go, go. Fat baby, go, 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 go. Fat baby, go.
I just like to write. I consider myself more of a writer than singer or whatever. And working with Dan and Noah here with the Superions is like a fun side project for things I can do I can't do with the band, because the band works, all four of us write together. And with the Superions, I write all the lyrics and Dan and Noah do the music, and it just works.
Something else to keep in mind, are you ready? Fred is now in his 60s.
You're what? Henry! Rusty!
Do you know that you are breaking the stereotype of what people think happens as you grow older?
Oh, I know. When I think about my grandparents, they were dressing... they were dressing like, well, the end is near, so I'm going to just wear a house coat or... old pants and things, so I don't know, you just have to think young.
Do people tell you, Fred, when are you gonna grow up?
I don't know. I'm successful being a nut like I am, so who cares?
Are you happy?
Yeah, I'm very happy.
And are you having fun?
Well, look at our videos.
So whether it's reliving the past with the B-52s or taking a shot at the future with the Superions, Fred Schneider still has the passion, still has the spark, and has no plans to change a thing.
I've accomplished whatever, except I'm not a, you know, top movie star, but, you know, I can live with that.
You never know.
You
never know who's watching.
That's true. Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Love Shack.
Fred Schneider of the B-52s. Up next, writer Delia Ephron talks about how the death of her famous sister Nora affected her life. Stay connected to Growing Boulder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures.
You're listening to Growing Boulder with Mark and Bill. You know, one thing we both have a whole lot of admiration for is somebody that looks at the world, who looks at life and sees it from a slightly unusual perspective, someone who helps us see the things that we have in a slightly different way. And our next guest certainly has that gift, and she has been sharing it with the world in her plays, in her movies, and in her books.
Oh, she is a best-selling author, screenwriter, and playwright, and you're going to recognize some of these titles like You've Got Mail or Sleepless in Seattle. And she's written over a dozen books, the most recent being Sister, Mother, Husband, Dog, etc. Let's say hi to Delia Ephron. How are you, Delia?
Fine. How are you?
Man, it's great to have you here. I know the book is really getting a lot of run because it's kind of a collection of essays that deal with, I guess, pretty much everything we deal with in life. Tell us about Sister, Mother.
Yeah, those are my major food groups.
Sister, Mother, Husband, and Dog?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what's in the book.
The book started because I was so close to my sister Nora, and we were collaborators, and I was born a sister, I'm second, and she was an amazing older sister, and she always said we shared half a brain, and if I was so lost after she died, and she was such a force that it seemed almost unimaginable that she could die, so that I started to write every day. It was sort of what got me through the day. I would go into my office and write, and it was a way to be together and make sense of what it meant to be for us to be sisters, to lose her, and I think in general what it is to be a sister, which is such an uncivilized and crazy relationship. I mean, my first memory of Nora is that she bit into a tomato in such a perfect way as to squirt juice in my eye. And I think I just started to sort of go back over our history together and understand it. And then the next thing I knew, I was writing about my 20s and how I blew my 20s, because when I was 10, I saw a movie called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And after that, all I wanted to do was move to the backwoods and make flapjacks for a wild man. So then next thing I know, I'm writing about my dog, you know? I mean, it just one thing led to another.
It sounds like it was cathartic in a way, helping you deal with the things that so many of us have to deal with, that all of us have to deal with if we live long enough.
I think that the great gift of being a writer is that you get to write about what happens to you, and then you get to some other place because of it. If you're going to write a memoir, if you're going to write anything, tell the truth. That's the most important thing. And otherwise, why bother?
Now, folks, we're talking with Delia Ephron, and she mentioned her sister Nora, who, of course, was the renowned director and writer, Nora Ephron. You guys were not that far apart. Nora died at the age of 71, I believe. Was there sibling rivalry growing up? Did you guys always get along as collaborators as well as you did in adulthood?
Well, we didn't always get along, no. I mean, sisters don't always, we certainly didn't, I mean, but I worshipped her when I was a kid the way you worship an older sister. I just wanted to do everything she did, and but as we started to collaborate, and we each got better at what we did. We would really fight. She used to say, Delia, if you tell me this one more time, I'm going to scream because I'm a relentless person. And I would be so worried she wouldn't make the change I wanted her to make. And then, so I would just keep after her. I mean, we had fights. And when we were adapting my book, Hanging Up, which was my story of the death of my, well, it's a novel. It's my first novel based on the death of my father. And it was, you know, when we worked on that, it was too hard to work on it because it was my father. Was it her father? And I think there's some things you can really collaborate on, and there are things that end up, you get into trouble about. And I tried to really, I wrote a lot about collaboration because I think it's one of the most important things in life. You know, we, as friends, we collaborate on life. I don't leave the house without calling one of my girlfriends up for advice. And in marriage, we collaborate on raising kids. And yet there are things that are so personal that you can't collaborate on. And you have to know what those things are. So, no, it was not always easy.
And as if it wasn't tough enough, there were four Efron sisters. All of you became writers. You and Nora were so close. You collaborated together. I'm sure all of your sisters kind of have that bond. And, you know, I think the book is a great metaphor for all of us because it is about you and your family and the truth. But it touches on all of us who have this family dynamic and who suffer from losses and have arguments and disagreements and parents that aren't perfect.
Yeah, I mean, what was your dinner table like? Do you remember? Because I began to think when I wrote this book that the dinner table was such an important part of our lives. It was, you know, my parents really wanted to raise writers, and they succeeded. They got four daughters to become writers. But every time I said something funny, my dad shouted, "That's a great line, write it down." And I was expected to bring my stories. I mean, not expected, but, you know, it was where I told the stories of what happened to me that day, and I learned to be a writer that way. I learned how to tell a story and how to make people laugh. And don't you think did you have a powerful dinner table in your family?
Not so much. You know, we had all different schedules. It was important we came together a little bit, but, you know, my dad was burnt out. We kind of were on our own in terms of, you know, trying to amuse ourselves and motivate ourselves. As a father, I was much more like your father. I engaged my daughters every night at dinner.
So, Delia, let me throw this at you. We've talked about, and we all get how important the mother or the sister or the father is, but dog?
Dog. Oh, my gosh. Do you have a dog?
I do have a dog. Love my dog.
If you have a dog, first of all, I got a dog when I was a stepmother, okay? So I think every step parent out there, this is my advice, get yourself a dog because it's very important to have someone in the house that loves you. So I got this dog and I fell in love. I mean, and that's what happens. I mean, a dog turns you into a nut. And it was really, I really had to write about it because I think that having a dog is a totally transforming experience. And there's something so powerful about them. And I got so cuckoo that, of course, I even had a pet psychic over because I was writing a movie about a pet psychic. So I had this very nice woman come over and tell me what my dog was thinking. And my dog... She said that my dog was very worried about my left thigh. So that was really amazing to me because it just so happened that I'd had something taken off my left thigh that week, which turned out to be fine, but I was waiting for results. And it was under my blue jeans. There was no way she could have known about it. There was no way the dog could have known about it, I didn't think. So I was just blown away by that. But anyway, all I want to say is that having a dog turned me into a nut, and there is something about them which is so powerful that it's almost impossible to describe if you don't have one.
Well, family and pets may be the only place that we can find unconditional love, and it sure is different with the pet than it is with the family members.
Well, we can find unconditional love with the pet, but we don't find it in our families, really. And I think that's why that they are really the fulfillment of a kind of... Imagine what you imagine love can be in its purest form is probably having a dog. There's 77 million dog owners in the country. The world is really dogs are all over New York City, by the way. I mean, you cannot believe how many dogs there are in this city.
You know, no, I wonder, Delia, though, you're such an interesting writer. I think it's because you really help us all feel like we're your best friend. Even in this interview, you've done that. You open your life in a way that helps us all and really relates to us. The book is called Sister, Mother, Husband, Dog. Do check her out at DeliaEfronWriter.com. What a fun interview. Up next, meet a true hero, one of the greatest advocates for orphans in the world, who's still making a difference in her 90s. This is Growing Bolder.
And a glimpse of our past fades away so fast, like a castanet dance in the night.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats to noble to neglect.
You're listening to Growing Bolder Radio. I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and time now for our Surviving and Thriving interview. You know, with the right support and the right attitude, it is possible to not only survive life's greatest challenges, but to actually thrive in the aftermath. And our next guest is a great example of that. Her story should really end that little debate that goes on in all of our minds once and for all about whether one person really can make a difference. Because if it wasn't for her, there would be a whole lot of people who simply would not be here today.
Yeah, and that's no exaggeration either, Mark. Let's go back to April of 1975 when this woman made a life-or-death decision that changed everything, not just for her. She was in Saigon. It was just about to fall when she helped over 200 kids get out of there in a dramatic air rescue called Operation Baby Lift. It was an act of heroism that continues to this day through an organization she founded called HALO, Helping and Loving Orphans. Let's say hi to Betty Tisdale. How are you, Betty?
I'm fine. How are you?
You know what? I hope you don't mind us asking you this, but I had heard not long ago that you suffered maybe a mild stroke or something. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, except that I use a cane once in a while.
Does anything keep you down?
I hope not.
And how old are you these days, Betty?
Oh, I'm going to be 92 on September 30th.
Just amazing. And folks, if you've ever wondered if helping others helps yourself, she's the perfect example because, Betty, you have an amazing anniversary that you're celebrating this year, 50 years of volunteering. Just think how rich you would be if you got paid for all that work, huh?
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Well, I thrive on people understanding what we're trying to do and sending donations.
So tell us, in your words, what are you trying to do? What's your mission?
Well, my mission in the beginning was just to help the children of Vietnam. And then it went on for other countries. We went to Bogota, and we went to the Middle East, to Afghanistan, places like that. And every place that I went, they needed more. In Bogota, it was the same thing. A little baby died in my arms because she couldn't get a heart operation. She was only about 6 months old. Beautiful child.
That's just one remembrance in a whole lifetime of changes in people's lives that Betty Tisdale has made. And Betty, you make a very interesting point about volunteering, and I think that's one of the reasons we wanted you on the show today. You are so inspiring. Your story is almost beyond belief, but you believe that it takes somebody else to inspire us to do things that we normally wouldn't do. In your case, your whole story happened because of a guy named Tom Dooley.
Exactly. And Tom Dooley was the most energetic, giving person that I ever met. I met him in New York. I read his book called Deliver Us from Evil. In fact, last night I was having dinner with people and they were going over to Laos. I said, I don't never hear of anyone going to Laos anymore. And I said, that's where Tom Dooley started his first hospital. And they were trudging through the jungles to get to his one-room hospital where all the patients were lying on the floor. Unbelievable.
The power of an example. So you saw what he was doing, and it inspired something in you. And, you know, Betty, we talk all the time, in fact, about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. You were a secretary when you were transformed, when you were changed, when you were inspired. What is it about you that enabled you to take the chance, to have the vision, to truly believe that you could make a difference?
Well, I guess I couldn't believe that there were people in the world, children in the world, that no one had helped. Because I grew up in Pittsburgh, and my father died when I was 9, and my mother was left with 5 children, and she had tuberculosis. And all of a sudden, you know, people were helping us. And, of course, the children, my sisters and I, were farmed out to other people, and other people took care of us. And that's what we're trying to do now. I say we, and I get the help of so many people from all over the world.
And you know, Betty, just like Dooley did for you, you are doing for who knows how many other people, setting the inspiration, being that example. Nobody would have looked one way or the other 25 years ago if you would have said, I think I've had enough, I'm going to retire. But here you are in your 90s, and you're still making a difference?
Oh, I'm not going to retire. I don't think I can. I have raised my children, and they're all successful, I think. And I love them very much. And I think that it's something that's in me that wants to help other children. And I just now, I've been to the Middle East, and I've been to Bogota, and I've been to Vietnam and Laos and so on. And I just keep looking at the map and thinking of all the children that are floating around the world that need help. And the funny thing happened the other day. I got a phone call from a woman by the name of Teresa. And she said, I don't know whether you know me or not, but I'm from Africa. And she said, I thought maybe you could give me some ideas on how I can raise money or how I can help the children there. And I said, I've been thinking about Africa, thinking so much, especially with this new disease that's in the world today, Ebola, and people are dying so fast. And I said, I'd like to talk to you, and maybe there's some way I could get to Africa and just help some of these children that are dying over there.
Well, you all...
I met her the other day. Wonderful woman.
So it goes on. Even in her 90s, she is stepping up, finding a need, and being one of those people, not asked to, not expected to fulfill a need, but somebody doing it because she believes it's the right thing to do. It's the power that's inside all of us to get out there and use our lives to make a difference. For Betty, it was the orphans of Vietnam and then the children of the world. For you, what's it going to be? What is it in your heart that you can make a difference in doing? Betty, thanks so much.
I've just closed my eyes again, climbed aboard the Dreamweaver train.
Up next, remember the song Dreamweaver? Well, we're going to talk to the amazing Gary Wright. That's next on Growing Bolder.
We've got news. Watch.GrowingBolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.GrowingBolder.com is now live.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
Believe you can get me through the night.
Well, you know this song. Everybody knows Dreamweaver. It was a multi-platinum hit. But do you know the guy who wrote it and performed it? You should, because he's a visionary songwriter, fabulous singer, world-class performer, and really, Mark, nothing less than a musical pioneer who has left an indelible mark on the music we all listen to.
Yeah, no argument here, but here is something that really makes his story exceptional and well worth paying attention to. While he would love to be recognized for his music, just as important to him is lending some spiritual guidance to any or all who are searching for meaning and purpose in this life. And that's what the song Dreamweaver is actually all about. His story is inspiring, it's enlightening, and fortunately, he's now written a book about it called What Else? Dreamweaver. Let's say hello to the always interesting Gary Wright. Hey, Gary, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Well, we're great. Thanks so much for your time, and let's get right with it. What made you decide to write this book, and why do it now?
Well, I had written so many songs over the years and have made so many albums that I really wanted to do something a little different. And I thought about the process of writing a book because people had come to me and said, you know, you've had a lot of very rich experiences that you need to share with the world, and you should write a book. And I thought, yeah, but, you know, I don't know if I could write a book. And then as I thought about it more and more, I realized that it was the same creative process that you write a book with. It's you're tapping into the same part of your consciousness. And I thought, I'm sure I could do this. And I started to write, and, you know, kind of a proposal to pass around to publishing companies. And I landed a deal with Torture Penguin and started to write. And they said, no, we want you to write it. You don't have to use a ghostwriter, which I was thrilled because that wouldn't have been in my own voice. And I just went through my life and the major decisions that I made that caused things to happen for me and the events. And I always felt that I had been guided to do certain things because things would always come out, you know, things would come in the mail or whatever, opportunities would arise. And I thought, wow, I never thought I could do that or that would happen to me. And I started to really then get into the spiritual path, especially through my friendship with George Harrison.
You know, Gary, most people need a ghostwriter because nothing happened in their lives to write about. Your story is amazing, Gary. It's one thing after another. And you brought up George Harrison. You recorded with him, but you were good friends with him, too. Is he the one that introduced you to Eastern spirituality?
He was. When I first met him and I played on All Things Must Pass, he right away picked up on the fact that I was definitely into the Eastern philosophy, not that I had known anything about it, because he really was my mentor, and he mentored me through that entire initial period, and it was a great experience to have him, a friend like him. He was so different than any of the other friends I have. You know, he was just amazingly creative in all the things he did, and a wonderful human being, very compassionate, very funny. He had a great sense of humor. He loved gardening, which we shared together, and so we had a lot in common.
Folks, we're talking with Gary Wright, who has written a new book called Dreamweaver. And Gary, most of the times writing a book is its own reward. You get so much out of it. Fortunately, this is a great book for everybody else. But was it cathartic in a sense as you revisited your life? What did you learn about yourself as you wrote the book?
I think I learned that, you know, in many ways I've been blessed with having a quote-unquote charmed life where opportunities have been presented to me and I've been able to, you know, meet such incredible human beings and to collaborate with them musically. And I just felt that I've always been guided, you know, in one way or another toward specific things that would enhance my life the way it has. But I think the most important thing was that I realized that it wasn't the platinum albums and the awards and the big concerts and stuff like that gave me the satisfaction. It was the ability to be able to uplift people, especially like when I would do concerts and when I still do concerts, people will come back after the show and when I'm signing autographs and tell me their own little story about Dreamweaver, how it changed their lives. Several of which people were with stories about people who were just about ready to end their lives for one reason or another, and they said, but I played your music and I decided not to do it. And I thought, wow. Now that justifies the whole thing of being an artist. It's not the fame or anything like that. It's the ability to have helped another human being and save their lives. And I feel very blessed that I was given that role in this lifetime to be able to have done that through my music.
You know, Gary, I can see how you can look back and say that, but when, all the stuff that you went through, man, I cannot believe that you didn't become a mega, mega star. I mean, even I was a huge fan of Spooky Tooth. Are you kidding? Mike Harrison and Mick Jones, how did that not become huge?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you have those examples of great artists I've run across in my life who never, their career never happened for one reason or another. And, you know, it's that's where I believe, you know, the law of karma comes into effect, because maybe they had to learn the lesson of being more patient or whatever that particular thing was. Maybe it wasn't meant to happen. Success is something that just doesn't plop into your lap. I wrote that in my book. It's something that you have to work on and hone in on and purify over different lifetimes. And then all of a sudden, when that moment's there, I mean, yeah, it's true what you mentioned before about mega star. So I often think about that in my career. Why wasn't I a mega star instead of just a mega star? But I think, again, with me, it was a situation that I had to grow. Had I just rushed into, you know, huge stardom, I probably wouldn't have learned the lessons that I needed to learn and not have been able to grow the way this life gave me the opportunity to do. So I feel, in a way, blessed that I was able to learn those lessons while at the same time having a successful career.
And all you've learned, Gary, gives you a foundation for the future, which many people in their 70s, as you are now, don't have. What have you learned about aging and your perception of how we can remain vital and significant as we get older? What can you share with us that you've learned?
Well, I've always been a firm believer of positive thinking. And also, you know, living a healthy life is very important, because if you don't look after your body when in the younger years, it'll start giving you trouble in the older years. So I've been pretty conscious about the kind of foods I eat. I exercise regularly. That's important. And I meditate. Meditation is a big part of it, too, because it kind of keeps you balanced and it keeps you centered and it allows you to live in the moment. I think what happens is that as we get older, we spend a lot more time in the past or the future and very little time in the present. And that's why all of a sudden it seems like, wow, 10 years just flew by. But I think when you're a little kid, you're saying, now what are we going to do next, Mom? What are we going to do next? You're living always in the present moment. So time seems to appear that it's actually stretched out, and it's you're living more in the moment, whereas when you're older, it doesn't happen that way. So it's practicing modern psychology calls it now mindfulness. In India, they call it practicing the presence of God. In other words, being in tune with that consciousness, so that you have, like, you're walking through life with somebody that's holding your hand and you're constantly having a dialogue with. And I think that's important. That's been my kind of success story, you know, on how I've, you know, learned how to age with dignity, rather than just be frightened and think, oh my God, I'm getting near the end of my life.
Didn't we tell you this guy was amazing? Gary writes all that. You got to read the book. You won't believe the things he went through. Almost got killed at the age of 16. He struggled through youth. He was on Broadway and worked his way, now in his 70s, still writing, still recording. Thanks, Gary.
Well, that's a wrap for today's show. But you know, the best thing about Growing Bolder is that it never stops. You can check us out 24/7 online at growingbolder.com and see why GB is one of the most talked about pages on all of Facebook.
See what a difference it makes to have hope, inspiration, and possibility in your life. Isn't it time you started Growing Bolder?
The Growing Bolder radio show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC. All rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, going high and mighty trapped. Countless fire and flaming rope, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I.
So much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Half-right prejudice leap for, rip down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white, spoke from my skull I dream. Romantic flanks of musketeers, foundation deep.
So much older then, I'm younger than that now.
In a soldier's stance I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach. Fearing not I'd become my enemy in the instant that I preach. Sisters pledge.